From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A vote on a strict abortion ban, maybe one of the strictest in the country, was the first item on the agenda for lawmakers in Alabama's state Senate today, and it immediately became fiery. Now they've delayed that vote at least until next week. Several other states are also limiting abortion rights. This week, Georgia became the fourth state to pass a so-called heartbeat bill, banning an abortion 6 weeks into a pregnancy or when a heartbeat can be heard by a doctor. It also grants embryos at 6 weeks and fetuses personhood. Alabama's abortion ban would criminalize doctors who perform the procedure. Andrew Yeager, reporter and host at WBHM in Birmingham, is on this story. And Andrew, we spoke to you last week when state reps passed their bill to ban pretty much all abortions, with the exception of a serious health risk to the mother. This was senators today. What happened and how different is their bill?
Well, there was a small difference, and that's what created that chaos in the Senate. When this bill was passed out of a Senate committee yesterday, the senators there added an exception for rape and incest. The original bill had no exception for rape and incest, but they added that in. And so when this bill was brought up in the Senate this morning, some Republicans moved to immediately table that amendment. The chair approved that, and chaos ensued with Democrats objecting to that. And so we had discussion around that procedural issue. And coming out of that, you had Senate President Pro Tem, Republican State Senator Del Marsh. He offered this.
This particular amendment that was just stripped was an amendment that I've always wanted on a bill, in any bill I've ever supported. And what I'm going to ask for, and maybe this would be the time, is that everybody needs to go home this weekend. They need to listen to the constituents about this bill with and without the amendment we just took off. And we need to come back in on Tuesday and have extended debate and make that final decision. And that's why I'm going to ask at this point that we carry this over to the call of the chair until we deal with this on next Tuesday.
And so, Andrew,
and that's exactly what they did.
It got pretty chaotic before that, though. Is that a surprise? As you've said, this seems to be... There are Democrats, of course, who wanted the exception for rape and incest cases. But is it a surprise that you have Republicans, as we just heard, who also wanted that?
Well, we kind of knew going into it that this was a point of contention even within the Republican caucus. Not all of them were keen with having a bill that didn't have that exception. What we didn't know is how exactly that was going to be dealt with, how it was going to play out. And as we saw this morning, it means delay and a little more time to work that out.
Well, and talk about, you know, because we are seeing this move in many states to bring up these bills. And in most of the states, lawmakers are saying, we are hoping that this goes to the courts. We want this to go all the way to the Supreme Court with two very conservative recent appointees. Is that the sense in Alabama? And how does it compare to the so-called heartbeat bills?
Yeah, the supporters of the bill here in Alabama are very explicit that they intend this bill as a court challenge. They expect it to be challenged and make its way through the federal court system. They hope to the Supreme Court, where the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision might be reconsidered. On paper, it is certainly a stronger bill than, say, the heartbeat bills we've seen in other states, because it does, at least in original form, does criminalize abortion in all cases except for the health of the mother. Opponents would argue, though, that the heartbeat bills functionally are an abortion ban because for many women, they don't know at 6 weeks that they're pregnant. But regardless of that, court challenges most likely are ahead, and that's what proponents of this legislation want to see.
Yeah. And how are pro-choice advocates, opponents, reacting to this bill?
Well, they're gearing up for the fight as well. You know, groups such as Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union of Alabama have promised a lawsuit here in Alabama if it does pass the legislature, is signed by the governor. In fact, there was a statement from the ACLU of Alabama after it passed a Senate committee, and it ended with, "They will see us in court," those exact words. And I guess that question is out there. Will a more conservative court rule differently on this issue, if the issue gets there?
We have under a minute, but we are seeing states move to limit abortion rights, but also some states trying to protect abortion rights.
We have, yeah. So as this debate rages, it's not just those on the anti-abortion side that are, you know, really going after, but you do have some on the pro-abortion rights side. We've seen a constitutional amendment that will go before voters in Vermont. It's already passed the legislature there. If it is passed by voters, it would establish a right to personal reproductive autonomy. So putting that into the Constitution there. New York has seen legislation as well. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a law earlier this year that would guarantee a fundamental right to an abortion in that state. Yeah.
So we'll
just
follow.
As you're seeing action here in more conservative states as Alabama, you're seeing it in more liberal states as well.
Andrew Yeager at WBHM in Birmingham. Thank you.
Glad to do it.
Let's go to Europe now, where leaders from EU countries are meeting in Romania today. The British Prime Minister, however, is not among them. Theresa May is back in London trying to get lawmakers to agree on a plan for the UK to leave the EU. Opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party said at a rally today that May's government is dismantling. So let's bring in BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. Rob, the Prime Minister has been in talks with the Labour Party to try to reach a deal, but given what Jeremy Corbyn is saying today, it doesn't sound like much progress is being made.
No, and I'd be amazed if they managed to reach an agreement. I mean, look, on the one hand, Peter, there's a certain incentive for both the opposition Labour Party and the governing Conservative Party to get Brexit out of the way, as they would see it. And that's because, my goodness, everybody in this country is utterly, utterly sick of it. Right. And they're both very, very frightened of Leave voters. But here's the problem, that it's incredibly difficult to see how either party could do that without either party completely splitting aside, because the governing Conservative Party, who truly believe in Brexit and having a very distant relationship with the EU, they can't bear the idea of doing a deal with someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who, as they would think of, as a dangerous communist. And those in the Labour Party, who are very much in favour of Britain staying in the European Union, are saying, what on earth are we doing trying to help the flipping government? That's not what oppositions do.
Another awkward part of all this is the European parliamentary elections that are coming up. The reason Corbyn was at that rally, he was kicking off Labour's campaign for the EU elections. UK wasn't meant to participate in these elections because they were supposed to be out of the EU by now. But, I mean, does that add any complications to everything? I mean, does it look like that's going forward as planned?
I'm not sure the word complication is one I would use. Bloodbath is the one I had more in mind for the main parties, because the real problem that the Labour Party and the governing Conservative Party have come up with is that neither one of them is, if I could put it this way, leave-y enough for people who like Britain to leave the European Union, or remain-y enough for people that want to remain. So what we think is going to happen at these European parliamentary elections, which absolutely, I mean, they look like being a bloodbath for the mainstream parties, that you'll get a lot of votes for this new party called, guess what, the Brexit Party, and you can guess what they want.
Right.
And then presumably everybody else will vote for parties which are broadly in favour of Britain remaining.
Happily for you, maybe, I don't know, there is something else happening politically in the United Kingdom other than Brexit. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in town this week, and he warned Britain about doing business with Huawei. It's the Chinese telecommunications company that could help the U.K. develop a 5G network. Let's hear Pompeo.
As a matter of Chinese law, the Chinese government can rightfully demand access to data flowing through Huawei and ZTE systems. Why would anyone grant such power to a regime that has already grossly violated cyberspace?
Rob, what about this story? Will Theresa May get involved with Huawei if the U.S. asks her not to?
It's a real dilemma, and you're absolutely right, Peter, in some ways. People in this country, anything that doesn't involve the B word, Brexit word, they're utterly relieved. But of course, in many ways, you see, this is connected to the B word, because this is all about Britain's new place in the world after it leaves the European Union. I mean, right. If you think about it, we had, as many would see it, certainly in the foreign policy establishment, we had this nice cozy spot where we were, you know, the United States' best friend in Europe. And one of the reasons we were US best friend in Europe is because we were the ones with the best friends, because we were part of the EU. And that sort of sorted everyone. The Europeans could get the UK to go and talk to whichever US administration was in power and sort of sort things out.
There's a need for new friends. You need the Chinese.
Yeah, well, you see, now with Brexit, does its desperation to do trade deals with China outweigh its desire to always be on the right side of the United States in strategic terms? So in many ways, rather than being, if you like, an escape from Brexit, this is just the kind of dilemma, the kind of problems that Britain will face in a post-Brexit world. How do you balance Washington, Brussels, Beijing, and who knows, Moscow as well, and others too?
Please tell me that baby Archie is an escape from the B word.
Baby Archie has definitely escaped from the B word.
You needed that, didn't you? I mean, the country needed a little Archie.
I think everybody has really loved the break with Archie. There was a lot of fun in the gap between the baby being born and the naming, of course. You can imagine the sort of fun people were having with the name. In
the
fact,
betting, yeah.
in fact, Brexit did come up because one pro-Remainer had suggested, prominent pro-Remainer had said, why don't they just call the baby? Why don't they name it Brexit? And then they could say, right, Brexit has been delivered.
Oh, boy, that would have been newsworthy. The BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you, Peter.
After tweeting over the weekend that special counsel Robert Mueller should not testify before Congress, President Trump backtracked today. He said he will let the Attorney General, William Barr, decide. All week, the fight between the White House and Democrats in Congress has been escalating over the fate of the Mueller report. Yesterday, House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler characterized it this way, following his committee's contempt vote against the AG.
We've talked for a long time about approaching a constitutional crisis. We are now in it. We are now in a constitutional crisis.
Well, today, House Leader Nancy Pelosi agreed, but Republicans, of course, have a different view. Here's former Attorney General Jeff Sessions talking to MSNBC's Stephanie Ruhle at the SALT conference in Las Vegas today.
I think we're not in a constitutional crisis yet, and I don't think very close to it. There's been squabbles between Congress and the Department of Justice and cabinet agencies for years over all kinds of discovery questions.
So it's just a squabble?
Well, that's what it amounts to, really.
Squabble or constitutional crisis? And why the switch on Mueller testimony from the president? Let's step back for a couple minutes with NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, nice to have you because we need some definitions here. Is there a solid definition of a constitutional crisis?
No. There's no formal or official or legal or even agreed upon definition of what is a constitutional crisis. Let's just say it's a point where the conflict between parts of the government, where the Constitution does not provide clear rules or guidelines, has been reached. And it does seem as though we have reached such a point or we are entering that kind of territory.
However, Ron, don't we need to wait to see how this plays out in the courts before we can say anything is a constitutional crisis? This is supposed to be part of the process. The courts are supposed to sort of step in and be a referee.
And the courts surely will. At some point, we're going to be paying a great deal of attention to John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, who appears at this point to be the closest thing to a swing vote, if there is one, on the United States Supreme Court. And we will be hearing from a number of other federal judiciary personalities between now and when we eventually reach John Roberts. We'll be hearing about it at lower levels of the federal courts as they rule on separate questions. This is going forward on a number of fronts. It's not just one committee. It's not just one congressperson. The White House likes to personalize these things and say it's all about Donald Trump versus Gerald Nadler. But there are actually quite a number of committees who are all looking for cooperation from the administration and being denied it. And we are also, of course, in the midst of this back and forth about when we're going to get to see the redacted portions of the Mueller report, if ever, and whether or not we're going to get to see the underlying evidence for that report, which is really what this is largely about.
Well, we mentioned the contempt vote yesterday of AG Barr for not turning over that full Mueller report. Barr says it would be illegal for him to hand it over. It contains grand jury material. Democrats, they say they want him to approach a judge to see if they can get that material unsealed. What's likely to happen there?
What's likely to happen there is that at some point or another, some form of accommodation will be reached about allowing people to determine what really was grand jury testimony that was redacted and what might have been redacted for other reasons. Right now, we only know what William Barr and a few of his assistants think needed to be redacted, and no one else's judgment has been brought to bear there. We have indications from Mr. Mueller himself, that he believes that some of his report was reported out of context by Barr, that some things may have been suppressed that need to be seen. And so, of course, there is great eagerness for us to hear from Mr. Mueller and for him to actually say what he thinks the report shows, and at some juncture, whether the grand jury material does come to light or not, and that can certainly be negotiated through a judge, as you suggested earlier. The other big question is how much else in this report has been essentially covered up, and how much of it really needs to be redacted, and how much of that underlying evidence could at least be shown to committees of the Congress, if not to the public as a whole.
Well, as you say, people want to hear from Mueller himself. We know he sent the letter to William Barr, seeming disgruntled at how his report was interpreted. But now we have the president saying he's going to leave it up to William Barr to decide if Robert Mueller should testify. And of course, you immediately think, why would William Barr, you know, it seems like the fix is already in there because William Barr has already said, I have concluded what this means and Mueller works for me.
He did say he would allow it, though. Yeah. Barr, right?
The president said today that he would leave it up to William Barr to decide whether or not Mueller testifies. Now, that is what the president said last week. But in between, the president sent out a tweet in which he said Mueller shouldn't testify. The only purpose there is to give the Democrats a redo. Now, of course, the Democrats would say this isn't a redo. We're just trying to get to the bottom of the first do. We're just trying to see what Mueller actually found. But the president tweeted that Mueller shouldn't testify. That threw everything into an uproar on that front as well as the others. And now the president says, well, I will leave it up to William Barr. After all, Barr has been a little ambivalent on this point, a little uncertain about it. And so at this point, perhaps that's a question mark again. We had once been given an actual date as a potential date for Mueller to testify. And that was going to be May 15th, but that was always tentative. But it does sound rather soon, and it does sound rather real. So if the president is not going to change his mind again, which is certainly something we can't rule out, it appears to be left to Mr. Barr, who at least knows what the president would prefer, even though the president has left it in his lap.
But what power does the attorney general have to stop Mueller once the special counsel leaves the Justice Department, which he is about to do?
Yes, he is. And at that point, he's a private citizen. And at that point, it would seem that someone would have to sue him to suppress him and not just give him a directive to say, no, you shouldn't testify. And even if someone does try to legally stop Mueller from testifying, Barr or the president, the Congress can push back and say, and here's where we get into crisis territory, we're saying by our authority as a co-equal part of the federal government, we want to hear from this person. The American people clearly want to hear from this person. There was a vote in the House earlier this year of 420-0 saying the Barr report should be shared with the public. Mm. We want to hear from this man, and we have something to say about it.
Well, on the other hand, we have Jonathan Turley, who is a supporter of William Barr and law professor at George Washington University. He's speaking out against the Democrats' contempt vote in an opinion piece in The Hill. He says Democrats have a weak case that could undermine their credibility. He says they've seen 98% of the report, and Congress is right on a number of complaints against the White House, but this is not one of them, the Barr vote. So what are you hearing about how strong the legal claim is that the Democrats are making?
Well, with respect to Jonathan Turley's statement, that's a version, a nicer version perhaps, of the White House saying that the House is embarrassing itself by insisting on seeing the full report. Mm-hmm. Either way, if you're the House and you see a cover-up happening, if you see the Mueller investigation and its report being stopped short of the finish line, you object. And your constituents and your supporters object. And they hold your feet to the fire on this question. And as for this 98% of the report point, you know, let's remember that the percentage that's been made public is not the important thing. It's the content of what has not been made public. Mm. For example, the White House tape recordings that Richard Nixon was forced to turn over back in 1974 by the Supreme Court, they ran for many, many, many hours. The material that forced Nixon from office lasted only a few minutes.
Ron, can we take a minute to talk about executive privilege? The president, as we've said just yesterday, claimed executive privilege over the Mueller report. But this is not something that was written into the Constitution. So remind us, what is it? Where did it come from?
This is another reason that we are entering into constitutional crisis territory, because the Constitution is silent on quite a number of things, and it does not specify what the executive privilege is. It does give a lot of privileges to the president. And over the years, presidents have expanded their powers and expanded their reach and jurisdiction, and they have said, we can protect this, we can protect that. And sometimes it has a national security aspect to it, such as we can't let you see that because it could endanger things that affect American national security, as opposed to embarrass the president on a business scale,
right,
or embarrass the president in some other fashion. So this is one of the things that's going to have to be sorted out in the courts. And ultimately, that was the great Watergate question. And when Richard Nixon lost that, he had lost his presidency.
Look, you mentioned, you alluded to Republicans as well wanting to hear some information. And we now know that the Senate Intelligence Committee, headed by a Republican, has subpoenaed the president's oldest son, Donald Trump Jr. This is over his involvement with Russians during the campaigns, you know, knowing how maybe that the talks about a Trump Tower in Moscow were going on far into the campaign, or, you know, that Trump Tower meeting to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. Now, he's been rebuked by other Republicans for even asking Donald Trump Jr. to come back. But what does that tell you?
It says that there is still some kind of question about that meeting and about what Donald Jr. may have testified about it back a couple of years ago. And there is still some question as to how different testimony, different witnesses may have corroborated each other or contradicted each other, and they'd like to talk to him again. Now, of course, Donald Trump Jr.'s attorney has taken the view that this is just a perjury trap and he doesn't need to go back, and there's really no attorney who would let his guy go back. So we're going to have a struggle over that too. This is all taking place on many, many fronts with many different attorneys involved, but all with the general theme that anything that has to do with Donald Trump, Congress can't see it unless Donald Trump wants them to.
And just quickly, the president has fought a lot of these other requests to investigate. Do you think Trump Jr. shows up?
Not at this time. There will have to be probably a court ruling to force him to do so.
All right. Well, we're going to keep an eye on this, obviously, as we have been. NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thanks very much,
as always,
for taking the time to talk to us.
You bet. Thank you both.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
High-stakes trade talks get underway today in Washington between Chinese and U.S. officials. After weeks of optimism that the trade war between the two countries was de-escalating, the mood on both sides has suddenly soured. At midnight tonight, President Trump promises to raise tariffs from 10% to 25% on $250 billion worth of Chinese goods. He also said today at the White House that the U.S. Trade Representative's office has already filed paperwork to start a brand new round of tariffs on an additional $325 billion worth of goods that includes cell phones and sneakers. Let's bring in Robin Farzad. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, good to speak with you. And this is an 11th-hour drama. Here's President Trump last night at a rally in Palm City, Florida, explaining why he's threatening more tariffs.
By the way, you see the tariffs we're doing? Because they broke the deal.
They broke the deal, did they, the Chinese?
I mean, mayhaps, kind of, sort of. Every side wants to be able to huff out of the room at this point and invoke kind of, I'm shocked, shocked. And you're playing more to a domestic political audience than anything else. I think, ironically, the China's kind of almost citing rule of law in that some of these changes that the United States was demanding in negotiations would have required the National People's Congress approving. And the Chinese felt that that just wasn't going to happen politically.
There were reports that the Chinese decided to try and ramp up the pressure this week by claiming that this thing about the law because they misread the signals and that they thought that the U.S. economy was weaker than it actually is. What do you think about that?
I don't know if there's much evidence of U.S. economic weakness right now. I mean,
right. You
saw the unemployment stats last week. It hasn't been this low in a long time, at least the headline number. The market's buoyant, even with these smallish sell-offs. If anything, I think Donald Trump might feel emboldened to up the rhetoric against China because of a perceived unstoppable U.S. economy, plus, you know, that election next year.
Yeah. So was this a bluff, or are we going to wake up tomorrow morning with higher tariffs?
I think Beijing and Washington are trying to go as far to the brink, as far to the edge as possible without doing something actually catastrophic. It's a game of chicken with trade at a time when both nations rely on one another like never before. You've previously seen deadlines repeatedly extended. I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happens here.
Okay, so Vice President Mike Pence is in North Dakota today, and he's meeting with farmers, and he's talking about trade. Now, this is interesting because a lot of farmers across the country, a lot of small business owners across the country, they were probably relieved going into this week that tariffs would be going away. Now, suddenly, maybe they're not. How do you think farmers and business owners are taking this news?
There's pain in the heartland. I mean, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis said that from January to June of last year, 84 farm operations across Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the Dakotas and Montana filed for Chapter 12 bankruptcy. And that's more than twice the figure from 5 years ago. But you're still not seeing pitchforks in the heartland, but there's definitely pain. You saw Senator Pat Roberts, a Trump ally, a Republican from Kansas, says there's a feeling in farm country we're being used as pawns in this whole business.
Mm. And the president has said that billions of dollars a year in tariffs are going to U.S. coffers because of the trade war with China. Just quickly, is that true?
It's hurting us in terms of Chinese investment into the U.S., which hit a 7-year low last year, you know, $5 billion versus $29 billion in 2017. But instead of building manufacturing in the U.S., you're seeing huge multinationals try out Mexico and South Asia first. So, you know, it's up in the air who's hurting more.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks so much.
Thanks, Peter.
It is a lot of fun to stride out onto a stage in the wake of the New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast and writer Patricia Marks here at the sold-out Brookline Booksmith event at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts. I'd be speaking with both, but the evening began with Roz projecting images on a huge screen behind us.
We are going to start with some slides here, class. This is my mother. This picture's from about, like, 1879.
Also larger than life.
Well, she was.
Roz Chast's late mother, Elizabeth, was formidable. Roz wrote a rather harrowing memoir about her a few years back. But on this night, she and Patty, best friends, are talking about Patty's mom, Janice, and their new book, Why Don't You Write My Eulogy Now So I Can Correct It? A Mother's Suggestions, a collection of Patty's mom's sayings with Roz's illustrations. We'll post some at herenow.org.
Right around the Magna Carta was signed.
After Roz illustrated Patty's first article when they were both around 23, it was Patty's mom who said, call her.
So I called Roz.
Yes.
And that was our first play date, right?
Yes, it was as if her mother had set us up on a play date. You girls are the same age. Go talk to her.
Yeah, right, exactly. Go over there.
That's exactly how it started. I'm going to show some slides from this book.
We see a couple. The man is humming. Patty's mom's saying reads, humming is hostile.
Yeah, this is obviously true. You know when you're like with your person and like you're kind of mad and say,
don't talk to me. I'm
yeah,
humming.
What are you humming? What are you? Oh, I don't know. This is never serve salmon when entertaining. It is boring. Oh, I love this one. never wear red and black together or you will look like a drum majorette. Over the years, I would hear these things from Patty about her mother. And I think this is the one there where I thought like, oh, well, that is so obviously true. How did I not know that? And it needs to be illustrated. Okay. You don't need to spend a lot of time in San Francisco. It's all frosting and no cake.
Did she really say that?
Yeah.
It's true, though.
It's, yeah. And now I'm just going to show a couple of cartoons.
This is Mom's Mortuary.
This cartoon is Roz's take on a mom's saying, and they are written on tombstones.
He never should have divorced his first wife. She was a floozy, and this is what happens to floozies. And he moved to Florida, and boom, 5 minutes later, he was dead.
This is,
This cartoon is all about Roz. We see a woman who looks just like Roz, gyrating in those squiggly lines she's famous for. A teenager, we learn is her daughter, is rolling her eyes. It's based on a time that Roz did try to dance with her teenager.
And she looked up and she said to me, "Mom, stop, you're hurting me." So, anyway, this concludes the slideshow portion.
We settle in to talk about both their moms, starting with Patty's. So your mom really did, and your mom is still with us at what, 90?
Yeah, she's 92 and she's in Philadelphia.
You know, it's interesting because you both, your mothers were both absolutes. They had absolute convictions.
And judgmental.
Yes.
And judgmental.
Yes.
In a good and bad way.
There's a huge difference because I just want to ask you, Roz, it's hard to characterize somebody else's mother. I don't want to, but would you say a rageaholic?
She was a bit of a battle axe, and she had, as we would say these days, anger issues, which made her probably a good principal. But as I said in the book, you know, if there was a crisis, I would just be like, oh, no, maybe I'll draw this. But she would know exactly what to do. You know, sort of some sad backstories. They had had a child, a baby before me that died, and I think that they were determined that, you know, my main duty in life was to not die.
See, my parents had some backstory. We had some kids, kids. But my parents' decision was, let's plow ahead and pretend nothing happened. Yeah. It would be complaining. Even to the doctor, you don't complain. So he'll say, well, why did you come? No reason at all. I feel fine.
Yeah. Wanted to see if you got any new magazines in your waiting room.
Well, I wondered, Roz, how much fun it was to then do this project.
It's going to sound incredibly corny, but I have always enjoyed collaborating with Patty. We have a very,
we have a good time.
We have a good time.
I, for one, thought that my mother was a witch growing up, even though people liked her. A literal witch with a broomstick who flew over the moon at night.
Why?
I just thought, you know, maybe was she yells at me to do my homework or something. I go, a witch. There's no other explanation.
Well, she did say some odd things. I want to check what's true, what's not. Was she really a guidance counselor?
She really was a guidance counselor.
Because that's interesting, a principal and a guidance counselor. And did she really say that gave her the opportunity to ruin not just three lives, but hundreds?
She really did. And she really did. I mean, my mother would have been a great something. And she joined my father in running an office supply business.
Mark's Office Supplies.
Mark's Office Supply, yeah.
So you had like a lot of sticky notes.
Why do you think I'm a writer? My father would say, we're going out tonight. Why don't you go write a bestseller? You have a lot of paper. We were also completely inept in my family. So if the light bulb blew out, it was time to move.
And look, Roz, I don't want to impose on your childhood something that you haven't already, you know, in the memoir, but it does seem as if your dad, you and your dad were trying to, you know, just, and this is going to be familiar to a lot of people, try to stay out of the line of fire, you know.
Totally. I have a black belt in avoidance. It's a...
Yeah. Is that maybe why you took to the illustrations, which are so funny and...
I think that among cartoonists, probably you're not going to find a lot of really happy people. That's just been my experience. And actually, I remember once, like, I made up this game, Penn Hospital. And I would take, like, all of the pens, like, from all the drawers, like, make Frankenstein pens.
Oh, God.
And where did the jittery lines come from?
Oh, probably a tremor.
We ended our talk with The New Yorker's cartoonist Roz Chast and writer Patty Marks with another look at Patty's mom's sayings. I'm skipping through some of them again to see. If you see me eating egg salad, you will know the diagnosis is terminal.
My mom, too, she would have these things that she would say. I'm sure everybody's thinking that. There's something poignant about it. She was just trying so hard to impart things to me. We were girls, and we were going to go out and do things they didn't do. And they wanted to fill us with the wisdom, whether or not it was, you know, San Francisco.
They wanted to arm us with what we needed.
But the evening was not over yet. Elizabeth and Janice's daughters, Roz and Patty, have taken up the ukulele. Here is their mom song.
And we, we're not about talent.
No, no. Okay.
On your mark, get set, go.
As I do your laundry, though you're 22, remember that I'll always be the boss of you. Did I mention starting now you're grounded? 'Cause all your pot I found it. P.S. I love you.
The New Yorkers Roz Chast and Patty Marks, their new book, Perfect for Mother's Day, is Why Don't You Write My Eulogy Now So I Can Correct It? A Mother's Suggestions.
It was the 19th century equivalent of the moon landing, an event that became an instant national media story. We're talking about the driving of the Golden Spike in the territory of Utah that connected the Union Pacific and Central Pacific to create the Transcontinental Railroad. Jeff London reports that tomorrow marks the event's 150th anniversary, and it's being celebrated all along the route.
It was the midst of the Civil War, which divided the nation north and south, and the president and Congress were also looking from east to west, says Patricia LeBounty, curator for the Union Pacific Museum in Council Bluffs, Iowa.
The 1862 legislation signed by Abraham Lincoln was really aspirational in tone, in a time in the Civil War that things were looking fairly bleak for the North.
It was to be a feat of engineering, the longest rail line ever built anywhere at the time. The Union Pacific was created by Congress to build from the east, but men were needed for the war effort, so Irish immigrants were brought in. The Central Pacific, which was already operating from California, would build from the west, and faced a different problem.
Because of the gold rush. They would hire plenty of people in San Francisco, get them up into the mountains, and they would run away to hunt for gold.
So the company also hired immigrants.
The majority of the labor force for the Central Pacific Railroad was Chinese.
Jason Ma has written a musical called Gold Mountain, which is being given concert performances in Salt Lake City and Ogden, Utah.
We down the trees, we wrench our knees,
we blast the rock, we can barely walk.
Ma says these immigrants from southern China had to blast through the Sierra Nevada mountains.
They used black powder. They experimented with nitroglycerin, but it was so unstable that it just resulted in too many deaths.
They must have made promise to their families to reunite with them somehow in America or back in China, and many of them didn't.
Chinese-born composer Zhou Tian has written a new orchestral work for the anniversary. The composer traveled the route doing research and talking to people along the way. He got ideas from a student in Salt Lake City.
She said flat melodies to symbolize the plains and deserts, and jagged melodies to symbolize the Sierra Nevada and Rocky Mountain ranges. And I was like, that's good. That's coming from a fourth grader?
The piece will be performed by several orchestras along the route, including the Utah Symphony. It was co-commissioned by the Reno Philharmonic. And conductor Laura Jackson says they originally thought of it as a celebration.
And I'm thinking, what have I done? I've asked a Chinese-American composer to compose a piece commemorating this history that just annihilated so many people that share his heritage. And I just turned to him and I said, we are not just celebrating, we are commemorating.
And not just the Chinese, the Irish workers, and Native Americans. There are no reliable estimates for how many of them died or were displaced resisting the incursion into their lands.
I always ask the question, where are the women?
Librettist Rachel Peters says in most histories of the Transcontinental Railroad, they were prostitutes. She and composer Lisa Despain try to correct that misperception in a short opera written for Utah Opera. They found a number of women who contributed, including one who registered 27 patents.
Her name is Eliza Murphy, and in addition to being an inventor, she was also a physician. One of her most famous patents was for axle grease, which doesn't seem all that entertaining. But we're making it sing.
I'm the engineer's eyes and ears, signaling effortlessly. Like a traffic cop, start and stop, passengers fate lies with me.
Every community from coast to coast was awaiting news of the project's completion. The Transcontinental Telegraph transmitted that news once the golden spike was hammered in place. The telegraph operator on site at remote Promontory Summit in Utah then typed one word in Morse code.
D-O-N-E, exclamation point.
Composer Joe Tien demonstrates on his phone.
I actually used it in the piece, and that became the very last movement.
The line that was finished on May 10th, 1869, is still in use today, says historian Patricia Labounty.
What's cool to me is that the first shipment on the Transcontinental Railroad from the west to the east was tea from Japan. So this wasn't just linking economic centers within our own country east to west, but this was linking people in our country to the world.
The Transcontinental Railroad transformed the country, for better and for worse, and its legacy is being remembered on the 150th anniversary of its completion, all along its route. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd, along with Robin Young. This is Here and Now.